determines and exposes negative cultural biases to which the suspect might otherwise not admit.
So it's a racist detector.
That's an oversimplification.
Hello, and welcome to the Cephalo Podcast, where we are discussing the HBO show Watchmen. I am your host, Scott.
And I'm Jason.
And today we are discussing Season 1, Episode 3, which is entitled, She Was Killed by Space Junk. The episode opens and we see a new character. It is a woman and she is in a blue phone booth. And it's kind of a like a computer-y phone booth, like it has a screen. And they make mention that it's using the True Satellite Orbit Array, which is a connection to a Mars antenna. So we are alerted to the fact that this is essentially a Dr. Manhattan answering service, and you can go to these specialty phone booths and, in essence, call Mars and leave Dr. Manhattan a message. So I think we talked about this a little bit before. So Dr. Manhattan is a hero in this universe, and he's brought, and he's been basically absent since the end of the comic. So for 30 years, he's been gone, but people still look up to him sort of as a savior. So much so that they have these blue phone booths scattered around various cities, and you can call Dr. Manhattan and leave him a message. This woman begins by telling a kind of a weird bricklaying joke. And while she's telling this joke, there's a quick cut to a taxi pulling up to a bank. And I just wanted to note that there's an American Hero Story ad on top of the taxi. So that was the show that they were discussing in the last episode. We see the main character. Her name is Lori. She walks into this. She gets out of the taxi and she walks into the bank. And she walks past a guy on the street, and he's reading a newspaper. And I always note the headlines on the newspaper, and that the headline said, Grisham to retire from Supreme Court. And I have no idea what that means, but I made mental note of it, that someone's going to retire from the Supreme Court. So we'll see. It's worth noting, I'll set the stage here. So Lori is a character from the original comic. She played Silk Spectre. She was Dr. Manhattan's girlfriend in the original comic. She was young. I think she was, like in her early 20s, like maybe like 19, I forget. She was the comedian's daughter. You find that out in the comic, that there was kind of a reveal that the comedian was her father. She didn't know about it. That comes up later in the episode. So just to set the stage, this is one of the few characters from the original comic that does come back.
Oh, okay. So it's not like Silk Spectre, I mean, or some of the other characters that I was trying to look up. It's a girlfriend that Dr. Manhattan had as Dr. Manhattan?
Yes.
In the comics?
Okay. So it gets a little bit convoluted, but her mom played Silk Spectre and then essentially retired, and she took over the mantle as Silk Spectre. So Silk Spectre, the vigilante, has been around for a long time. But Lori was the one that ended up dating Dr. Manhattan. Dr. Manhattan falls in love with her. You know, they date, they have sex. He kind of like cheats on her with science because he clones himself and he's doing two things at once. So all those things I mentioned in the earlier episodes about weird stuff that Dr. Manhattan did, it was while he was dating Lori. They do ultimately break up just because he doesn't really have the ability to maintain a human relationship just because of the way he perceives time. And he's not a human. So it's hard to maintain human emotions and human relationships.
Well, later, I guess we'll get to it, but she tells a joke about, and then one of the characters is Dr. Manhattan in the joke. And the Dr. Manhattan says, I fell in love with a girl, I walked on the sun, and then I fell in love with another girl. So is she the second one or the first one?
She is the second one.
Okay. Interesting.
So it's not super important to this story, but I don't even want to go into it. The point is that she's Dr. Manhattan's second girlfriend, which at the time was huge news, right? Because Dr. Manhattan's, like a celebrity, and he's in essence dating, a human girl. So it was big news. I don't know. It'd be like, like when Kim Kardashian and Kanye West started going out, like it was like everyone was talking about it kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, they show like the cover, like the magazine cover of her and Dr. Manhattan at the very end. And so, like, we get some bit of information from the episode about it. But, like, it would be nice if they explained more, I guess, of her character. But that's not the show's MO.
Yeah, it's good to know, but it doesn't make the, you know, it doesn't make or break the story. So just know that she dated Dr. Manhattan a long time ago and they broke up. And we'll get to the rest of it.
I want to argue because they reference, like, the characters around her treat her like she's different, especially this agent she travels with, and like kind of acts like she's famous, and you don't know why, and so it's like kind of confusing. But I guess I'm used to it. But
she was not well known as Silk Spectre. None of the original Minutemen were, I would say, famous for being Minutemen. I get the impression from this show that Laurie is famous for working for the FBI and being ruthless. So I think the reason that everyone is deferential to her is because she's incredibly good at her job and she doesn't take shit from anybody.
Oh, okay. That's not what I got at all, but okay. We'll go with that.
So what we see is Laurie walks into a bank. She walks up to a teller. She essentially pulls out a gun and robs the bank. And just as, you know, the teller is about to hand over the money, we see like a smoke bomb up above. And there's a gentleman in what appears to be like a Batman suit. It's like a rubber kind of suit. And he comes down. You know, he's going to foil this bank robbery. He's going to save the day. Laurie grabs one of the members or the one of the customers in the bank and uses her as a human shield. Fake out, it's a trap the whole time, and all the people in the bank are essentially FBI agents, and it was all a ruse to lure this masked vigilante out into the public so that they could catch him, because remember, in this universe, masked vigilantes are not allowed since the Keene Act has been in place. So the whole setup was a sting operation on these masked vigilantes. When the Batman character realizes what's happening, he makes a run for the door, and Laurie just straight up shoots him in the back, like cold-blooded. And one of the cops outside has a great line. He says, "Hey, Blake, how did you know his body armor would stop the bullets?" And she just kind of like walks past him. She doesn't like acknowledge or anything. But it was very clear that she plays fast and loose with the rules. She's kind of her own, I don't know what the word is. She marches to the beat of her own drum. She doesn't take orders from anybody. She was clearly in charge of this operation, and she did what she had to do to catch this guy.
Well, you can tell she has more than just a job for her. Like throughout the episode, you can tell she has a disdain for vigilantes, masked people. You know, she calls them, she says this guy's, you know, he's a fucking joke is what her quote is about this guy. So yeah,
which is ironic because she was a vigilante for a long time. So it's just worth noting. So this whole first scene is really just set up for who this character is, because the last time we saw her, she was whatever, 21, and she was palling around with Warshak and Night Owl and you know, being a vigilante. And now she has essentially gone, you know, straight and narrow. She's working for the FBI. She's ahead of an anti-vigilante task force. So that's essentially what we need to know from the first scene.
She goes home. She says, "Play Devo music." Or music starts playing from an automatic CD player from her voice command. She gets a glove, opens a box with a mouse in it, feeds the mouse to something behind a curtain.
Can we stop for 1 second?
Yes.
So she walks into her apartment and she says, you have to bear in mind, this was kind of new at the time. I don't think Alexa was a thing, but she says, "Play Devo," and the CD player kicks on. So it's not a streaming service, but the fact that there's something that responds to her voice is cool. I think it's just new technology in this universe. I think we take it for granted now, but I don't think it was as prominent back then. But she says, "Play Devo," and the CD player kicks on, and it's the Devo version of Mongoloid. It's the 2009 remaster. And I only make mention of that, and I looked it up because I've been looking up the lyrics of all the songs in this, because they all have something to do with the story. Every music cue in this is very curated. So I'll just read you some of the lyrics and then we'll move past it. Okay.
Hmm.
Let's see. I'll skip ahead just a little bit. Mongoloid. He was a mongoloid. One chromosome too many. Mongoloid. He was a mongoloid. And it determined what he could see. And he wore a hat and he had a job and he brought home the bacon so that no one knew. He was a mongoloid. Mongoloid. His friends were unaware. Mongoloid. He was a mongoloid. Nobody even cared.
Okay.
I don't want to give you too much more than that, but that's very much a clue of what's happening in the story, and I'll probably circle back to it when we get there. But just be aware that the music, you know, like the end of the other episode had, you know, that egg, the Red Hot Chili Peppers egg song. This is a song about, you know, I guess somebody that's working a job and his friends are unaware. All right, that's all. I just want to make mention of that.
Got it. Okay. Well, so she takes the mouse to feed it something behind the curtain, sits on the bed and opens a suitcase she got from under the bed. She looks like she's about to relax and do something with what's in the suitcase. I don't know. We'll get to that. We don't know at this point. And mm-hmm. she enters the code 667. And just as she's opening it, she hears a knock at the door and then she says, "Stop, Devo." Which is very convenient. She doesn't have to say like Alexa or anything. She just says "Stop, Devo." Like Devo is a command.
Did you happen to look up what 667 is a symbolizes? I guess is the right word.
No, huh?
So 667 is it's an angel number and it's associated with the guardian angels of protection, healing, and love. Okay, so if I'm remembering right, at one point she does open the briefcase, but we do not see what's in the briefcase. I think there might be kind of a Pulp Fiction-esque thing where like the she either looks into the briefcase and I don't want to say gets excited, but she's pleased by what she sees in the briefcase. Like it gives her comfort. And then
there is like a bit of blue light coming from the suitcase.
That's what I was going to say next. That's what I remember. I couldn't remember. Okay. So the point is there's a Pulp Fiction-esque thing where there's something in this briefcase. So there's your Chekhov's gun of this briefcase. Right. And it's, and again, all the numbers in the show mean something. So the fact that the code to this is associated with guardian angels, protection and healing is a clue. So, yes, she gets a knock at the door and she sighs. She's very like frustrated that she got interrupted and it's Keen at the door, right?
Yes. And he says he's been trying to get a hold of her. And then he says he heard that she caught the Revenger. She says, no, it's just Revenger. No, the. And that was last month. Today was Mr. Shadow. Keen thanks her for keeping our streets safe from rich assholes playing dress up. I had a note here. Why does it keep our streets safe if the assholes are trying to stop robberies? I mean, I guess I want to see more of an example of why Blake really wants to go after vigilantes, why vigilantes are thought of as like really bad, or at least to her. So I'm confused, or I just don't understand the motivations, I guess, a little bit. I'd like to see more, but. Keen comes into her apartment and takes a look at, it's an owl behind the curtain.
He says, "Can I peek?" And then he looks under the curtain and he says, "Oh, what's his name?" And Laurie replies, "Who?" And he says, "The owl." And she says, "Yeah, that's his name." So there's a total, it was a great, like, who's on first, like just a quick thing. I loved it.
Yeah. So this is where I started looking up stuff. Cause I remember an owl superhero from the comics, and so I was like looking up the owl character, and I just got more confused as I look things up. So anyway, I am not a smart man, but
just to clue you in, okay, so Dr. Manhattan and Laurie break up and Laurie actually starts dating Night Owl, which is where this owl reference comes from. That's where the little spaceship in the first episode comes from that Judd pilots and crashes. That's where the goggles come from. Night Owl was essentially the Batman or the Iron Man maybe of that universe. He was kind of like an inventor. So that's where that comes from. She has a fond place in her heart for Night Owl.
Yeah, so, but I mean, as a noob, as someone not knowing the comic, I don't know any of this. Like, this makes no sense to me. I know, I mean, I know I maybe I feel like I should know, or at least I know enough to know that I should know something about it, but I just wish the show worked a little bit more on its own and not so much heavily relying on the backstory of the comic. But so continuing, Keen talks with Miss Blake about investigating the hanging of Chief of Police Judd in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He says she'll be assigned to the case by the deputy director. He asked him to assign her to the case. And so he's just coming to, I guess, like kind of convince her to go, or kind of warming her up a little bit to the investigation, maybe. Keen doesn't think it was the 7th Cavalry. He thinks it was a vigilante, and has a flimsy reason about them being envious, especially with the masks. Like, vigilantes are envious of the cops, or something along those lines. I didn't really buy it. And he also says that the 7th Cavalry usually always takes credit for this type of thing, so that's suspicious.
And they did not take credit. I think at one point he says they were mysteriously silent, right?
Yeah, right. So they debate the mask policy a bit. He says someone's trying to start a war, and if they do it, everything goes to shit. And Blake says, and you don't get to be president. And he says that his sort of career is built on this policy about cops using masks. And if this goes wrong, if it doesn't work out, you know, this is sort of like a policy platform that he has, and I guess he's being ambitious.
Is his legacy, right? His dad did the Keen Act and he's following up on it. So them being, you know, incognito is his deal. And if them getting murdered causes a race riot or a riot of some sort, then it looks really, really bad for him.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I do want to make mention that Lori does not like the cops wearing masks. She's very much against the idea of masks and essentially hiding your identity. And she asks him, she's like, you called it DOPA, the Defense Against Police Act, which I thought was funny. Or Defense of Police Act? Yeah, whatever.
Of Police Act. DOPA. Isn't there something else? There's another act that's simpler, similar to that acronym.
Yeah, you're right. There's a quick, not to cut you off, but there's Keen responds with, he's trying to convince her to go and investigate this where Judd was murdered. And he says the president can pardon anybody he wants, anybody. He could even get your owl out of that cage. So again, he's talking about Night Owl, who is Lori's ex-boyfriend. You know, I mean, again, it's been 30 years. We don't know if they're even talking or they're still, but I mean, they used to pal around. So it's likely that they're still friends. And he's basically essentially trying to bribe her, like, hey, if you go do this and I'm president, I'll see what I can do to get your buddy out of prison.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's actually Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA.
Oh, that's yes. Okay.
And that was a federal law passed by the 104th U.S. Congress, signed into law by President Clinton, an act to define the protect the institution of marriage. So is that anti-same-sex? Or, yeah, it banned federal recognition of same-sex marriage.
Yes.
But that's so not maybe that's reference. I mean, that's not what they're talking about, but maybe that's kind of a reference to him being a bit right wing, maybe, or
yeah, that's exactly what this is that so the White Knight happened, right? And yeah, then the only response that they could come up with to keep the entire police force from quitting, because otherwise they're all going to get assassinated, was the Keen Act, which allowed it banned mass vigilantes and it allowed the cops to wear masks so that they were safe. So yeah, it's his response is basically, I'm going to double down and do everything I can to protect the police, even so much so where I'm going to allow the police to wear masks and get away with things that they wouldn't normally be able to get away with.
There's a nice shot of while they're talking, there's like a shot of the four characters from the comic in kind of a Warhol style poster depicting what looks like Ozymandias, Dr. Manhattan, Night Owl, and then Laurie's face is obscuring the fourth one, but it kind of zooms out and there's a woman there. So you're assuming that's her, you know, a poster of her. So she's one of those four main characters from the original comic. That's why I assumed she was kind of famous and people knew her, because there's a poster from her, you know, and it, I guess initially in this scene. So the fourth one, Silk Spectre, I guess, is her.
Yes, that's her alter ego, yeah. And it's a cool, like you said, a Warhol-esque, you know, four-quadrant painting of, yes, the four of them, you know, kind of the main characters in what would have been the Minutemen.
Yeah. The absence of the comedian seems relevant to me. I don't know if it is, but just...
So when Laurie was in the Minutemen and she was palling around and doing things... It was after the comedian was dead. So okay. The Minutemen were around for, you know, I don't know, quite a while. And that's why that when the comedian was in the Minutemen, it was a different group of people. In fact, the comedian actually ends up sexually assaulting Laurie's mother. And he actually gets her pregnant. And that's where Laurie comes from. And so he was kind of a jerk. And even Laurie knew that. And so she gets into it with her mom, like, why did you stick with him? And she says, you know, well, it's complicated. People are complicated. And she's implying, well, yeah, I got pregnant with you, so I couldn't just dump him. And so anyway, the point is that the Minutemen were around for, I'm just going to pick a random number, like 30 or 40 years. So there was a couple different generations of Minutemen. And Silk Spectre / Laurie was in the last iteration right before the Keene Act and the Squid thing happened. And then it was outlawed. So what you see on that painting is essentially the four of them. There were a couple more, but for the purposes of that painting, they just did the main four. The next scene is real quick. I'll cover. We see Laurie is driving, and it cuts back to the true phone booth, the Dr. Manhattan phone booth from the beginning, and she's now telling a new joke. So the bricklayer joke has... completed. She says, oh, well, I told the joke wrong, never mind. And then she starts telling a joke, like you said earlier, about three people who get to the pearly gates and they are asking God to get into heaven. The first guy is Night Owl. He talks about, you know, being good with technology. She basically describes Night Owl. And God says, okay, how many people did you kill? He says, well, what are you talking about? I didn't kill anyone. I'm a good guy. God snaps his fingers. He goes to hell. Second guy is Vite. He's considered smarty pants, smartest man in the universe. And God asks him, how many people did you kill? And he says, I killed 3 million. I dropped a squid on New York. And God says, not good enough, snaps his fingers, and he goes to hell. Third guy is Blue. He's considered a god himself. He has powers to teleport. He can walk on the sun. He can do things like that. And God says, how many people did you kill? And he says, a live body and a dead body have the same number of particles. It makes no difference to me. So that's a reference to Dr. Manhattan being detached from humanity. He says the same thing about in the comics, is he has a weird view of humanity. He thinks that they're interesting from like a scientific point of view, but doesn't necessarily want to participate in humanity. And God says, well, if you didn't kill anybody, I'm not interested. Snaps his fingers and he goes to hell, right? So all three of these characters that Laurie knew in this joke that she's telling end up going to hell. And then that's the end of that scene.
Well, this is all interspersed throughout the whole episode.
It's kind of told weird, and it's spread out from the beginning of the episode to the end of the episode on purpose, and we'll get to why at the end. But for the purposes of that joke, I put them all together. The point is that there's three guys and they're trying to get into heaven and none of them get in.
Yeah. And even before that, she actually tells a first joke about a bricklayer and then a girl. The bricklayer's like super precise, and he builds like a barbecue or something.
And there's an extra brick.
There's an extra brick, and then he gets all mad, smashes it up, and the girl's like, "I have an idea," throws it up in the air, and then the joke goes nowhere, and then she goes into this other joke.
Yeah, she says, "Oh, I told it wrong. I'm going to tell you a different joke."
Right. Yeah.
And then she starts telling, and then the next scene, when it cuts back, she tells this joke about the three people. And then the brick joke comes back at the end. We'll get to that at the end.
Okay. And I'll cover. None of this made sense to me, but so maybe you can explain it later. Okay. But I mean, it's cool. It's like kind of interesting dialogue. And I just thought it was kind of flavor for this character talking into this phone booth that may or may not be heard by Dr. Manhattan. She seems to think that she wants to just at least wish it might, you know. She doesn't have like any real illusions that it would, but it's more for her to talk to him in a legitimate way.
I think it's like therapy, right? I mean, it's therapy for everyone. That's why they have these phone booths that anybody can go in and send Dr. Manhattan a message.
Okay. Yeah.
What we see real quick, I'll do one more quick scene and then you can cover the next one. We cut to an FBI meeting room and they are having a powwow. I don't know, there's probably 20 of them sitting around an actual slide projector. And they are talking about the 7th Cavalry. They are talking about Judd's death. And they are going to go in and investigate. We see a brief slide of Rorschach's journal from 1985. We actually see the cover of the journal, and then we see an actual handwritten page. And the main FBI guy admonishes the character, or the guy who's running the slideshow, who put the slideshow together. His name is Petey. And he says, "What is this?" And he's like, "Well, this is a page from Rorschach's journal. It's relevant because the 7th Cavalry designed their masks and their ideology after this character. So I just thought it was appropriate." And the main FBI guy is just not having it. He's like, "It's not the 1980s. Why do I care about this? Let's move on."
I have a theory about this guy. I think he's important. I think maybe he's Rorschach. I guess Rorschach died.
He did. What happens actually is Dr. Manhattan kills Rorschach.
Okay. So I could be wrong about that, but I don't know. I feel like this is a kind of a known actor. So I feel like if he's just a throwaway one scene guy, that would be weird. So that gives me a feeling like he's important. At least, you know, the guy leading this presentation. I did want to note like the way he talks about the history of Tulsa and how, the cops go after everybody. He's talking about how the black people are going to Tulsa and getting their rewards, or their redfordations. And then the white supremacists don't like that. And he says, "Well, you know how white supremacists are." Basically, he's basically talking about how they are anti-white supremacists in this scene. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if – I don't love this vantage point of like the inner workings of like a FBI agency, intelligence agency, being obviously pro African American. I don't know. It just like if you're trying to say something about systemic oppression, it just completely whitewashes the idea of systemic oppression, in that there's the inner workings of the state are all in against these white supremacists, and it just rubs me the wrong way a bit. And then the way he says in Robbie Redford's America, the cops even defend black people. Like it's kind of a dismissive thing where he says, "Oh, you know, we'll even like step up to the plate and we will defend black people." It's just a really strange way of putting this. Maybe I'm reading way too much into it, but yeah. So he talks about the White Knight and the history of the masks and the police force and stuff like that. And,
they give a little bit of the official background, you know, for the FBI government explanation for what the White Knight was. It's interesting that he mentioned that they're fighting masks with masks. So the 7th Cavalry has Rorschach masks on. So their response to the White Knight was that they mask up all the cops, and then the cops can go essentially vigilante on the 7th Cavalry. Ultimately, yeah. it ends with that they want to send a bunch. They want to send a huge task force into Tulsa to investigate Judd's death, but Lori shoots them down. And she was like, no, I don't want to spook the locals. If we go in with, 40 FBI agents, they're all going to clam up and we're not going to get anything. And she just offhandedly says, OK, well, I'm going to go in with one. He makes her take one person. And she's like, OK, I don't know. I'll take that guy. And she points at the guy running the slide projector. It just doesn't make any sense because he's kind of a nobody. He's just this nerdy guy that put together this slideshow. So it was a little bit strange, and the way how dismissive the FBI chief was of the Rorschach journal, like the 7th Cavalry, everything they do is based on this journal that Rorschach left. Like, wouldn't you want to know like a little bit about it? Maybe I don't know.
Yeah, that was weird. It was an obvious like hey thing, the slide, and then don't talk about it and move it on, right. Move along. I don't know. Yeah, it was an obvious thing. But the scene did give me the impression that she has a lot of pull in the agency. She's somewhat senior and she can make these kinds of decisions. And she picked this guy that she thought she could basically push around. I think that's as far as I got with that.
Yeah. But. Okay. Well, that's the end of that scene. You want to talk about the plane scene?
Well, they fly into Tulsa. They're in the plane and Blake wakes up with the colleague talking about using a mask like the police wear. He says like when in Rome. So he wants to like try to wear a mask like the police do. I guess it's like, it must be a thing that people want to do, or it's like a taboo thing for people to wear masks. It's like a, I don't know. It's just something. It's a subject of interest.
It's something that only the police are allowed to do.
Yeah. So the pilot on the intercom says the Millennium Clock is visible outside. They take a look. It's like a giant tower thing. It looks kind of like the Eiffel Tower, but with like a big round thing on the top.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't appear to be moving or anything. I'm sure this is like a reference to something, but I don't know what it is.
It's not a reference to anything that you, it's not a reference to anything that what's he mentions next is that the Millennium Clock was built by Lady True, and Lady True bought Veidt's company after what happened in the original comic, and Veidt is disappeared. He had a very famous company, and he was essentially the Elon Musk of his time, and he disappears. So Lady True comes in and buys up what's left of his company, and she uses some of those resources and she starts building the Millennium Clock. And we do not know what the Millennium Clock is, except that it's this kind of like futuristic looking building, like you said. It's very much a Chekhov's gun kind of thing, like, oh, this is really cool, but it doesn't pay off till later what it is. But it's worth noting that it was brought into being after Lady True bought Veidt's company. And Lady True is also the company, the lady that makes the Dr. Manhattan phone booths.
Got it. Okay. Well, the FBI agent says he's got like a friend in Argentina. And that guy has like says something about a rumor about Veidt being in Argentina, living incognito, I guess got plastic surgery. It sounds like a conspiracy thing about Adrian Veidt, that he's still alive. And I'm sure there's like a bunch of theories going on, but that's a weird reference. It's then there's like a bit of an awkward conversation about him being a fan. And she kind of oversteps herself and like asks, like, do you want an autograph? Being kind of defensive about it. But he lists off his like credentials, and kind of to prove he's not like a silly fanboy, about how he has a a doctorate in history, I think. PhD in history.
So he legit knows his history. He's a student of history, which is why he knows who Laurie is. He actually makes mention. He talks about. He says he looks out the window at the millennium clock and he says, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Laurie says, "What?" And he explained, he's like, "Oh, that's what Lady True said when she was building a statue." And so I looked up that quote, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, because it's famous. And it's from an 1818 poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley. And then the title of the poem was Ozymandias. So there's a clear connection between Lady True and Ozymandias. And it gets even deeper because I was looking in that quote in the poem is about somebody building a statue as well. And the statue was erected in honor of a mighty ruler. And as the inscription on the pedestal at the foot of the statue reveals, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. So she's building a statue much in the same way that this poem references. So, and the poem is named after Ozymandias. So that's all I'll say.
It's named after Ozymandias.
Well, the name of the poem is Ozymandias. And that was Veidt's alter ego.
Gotcha. Who is Ozymandias in his? Is that a real historical figure?
I don't believe so. I believe he's just a character from this poem. I'd have to look it up though.
Oh,
I don't think he was an actual historical figure. He might be. I don't know. I'm not a history guy.
I quickly looked it up. Ozymandias was the Greek name for Ramses II, an Egyptian ruler whose empire crumbled to dust long ago. The declaration, look on my works, ye mighty, in despair, was supposed to be triumphant, and originally was. When the statue was first built, people gazing on it were meant to look at the empire by Ramses and be cowed into submission by its vastness and power. The statue seems to be saying to any mighty rival emperor who might be tempted to invade Ramses' kingdom, to look around you at everything I have built and despair of ever vanquishing me for the empire I have made.
It's a dick waving contest. Like, look at this big thing I built. How can you possibly outdo me? I'm the greatest person in the world, which is exactly what Lady True is doing by building this millennium clock.
I guess the idea of it though, is his empire crumbled and it becomes ironic, after the passage of time. It's not just that, but it's pretty, that's quite the reference, and that's literally Ozymandias, the character, so that is referencing this. So this is like a Greek name for Ramses II, an Egyptian ruler whose empire crumbled a long time ago. Okay, so interesting, weird.
Petey asks Petey if he wants an autograph. And that's when he tells her, he says, no, I'm a legit, I have a PhD in history. And then he says, sorry for pretending that I don't know who you are, because everybody else kind of like kowtows to her because she's, you know, famous and they don't want to ruffle her feathers. And he mentions that he knew, he mentions Ozymandias and Adrian Veidt. And basically the scene ends with Laurie saying, yeah, I knew Adrian Veidt. I too am not a fan. And then we see Pete and Lori, and they are staking out a warehouse. They're sitting in her car.
There's a little bit of, she continues telling her joke in this part.
Oh, does she?
And there's like little cuts of her investigating the crime scene. And then she drives out to Judd's house and goes inside to meet with Judd's wife at this point, before the warehouse thing, just assuming she's doing an interview with Judd's wife. And then they go to that stakeout in front of the weird warehouse thing. Yeah.
And we see Lori gets out of the car and she tells Petey to stay in the car. And I think at one point, doesn't she say, don't eat those nuts or something too? Like, she's just like, you know, throwing her weight around, even with Petey. And mm-hmm. she walks up to, we see Pirate Jenny and Red Scare, and they are manhandling a suspect. They have most likely rounded up some 7th Cavalry member, and they like throw him out of the back of this truck. And like, she walks up on him and catches him, and they're like kind of surprised. And she asks like the guy that's on the ground, like, oh, excuse me, sir, are your civil rights being violated? And he's like, yes, absolutely. And she's like, never mind, I don't really care. And they asked her, like, whoa, who are you? What are you? Why are you here? Like, how do you know about kind of our essentially our secret hideout? And she says, I'm Special Agent Lori Blake. Who the fuck are you? Like, she just takes no shit from anybody. It's great. And so they're at the police warehouse from the first one, from the first episode, where and so they go inside, and there are tons of suspects. And they are getting DNA samples from all of these essentially 7th Cavalry members, looking if they can make any connections to Judd's murder. I thought it was interesting. Several of them are K-9 units. They're walking around with dogs on leashes. And the K-9 units, they actually have masks that look like dogs instead of the yellow masks to hide their identities, I guess just to separate them.
Huh. Interesting.
It's just a little thing in the background just to, you know, flesh out the universe a little bit. Lori is looking. She wants to go find Looking Glass. She wants to have a discussion with him. She finds him in the pod, and she walks in. I love Lori so much. She walks into the pod, and she goes to sit down on the chair, and she's like, oh, what's this? And it's the remote control for the pod, and she picks it up and just starts hitting the buttons, and like Looking Glass is like freaking out. He's like, can I have that back? Don't touch that. What are you doing? Right? But she just does not care. And she says, so, like, what is this thing? Like, what's this pod that we're in? And he says, it determines and exposes negative cultural biases to which the suspect might otherwise not admit. And Lori goes, oh, it's a racist detector. And he goes, no, it's more complicated than that. And then, you know, Lori, she had been having those, I forget, seeds or nuts in the car. And she, like, starts to check, like, her teeth in Looking Glass's mask reflection. I mean, the whole point, just this character just doesn't care. She has no respect for personal boundaries. She's got a job to do, and her job is to solve these crimes or do whatever it needs to get done. And she just doesn't take crap from anybody, even, you know, essentially the high muckety mucks at the Tulsa PD, because Looking Glass is a detective. So are Pirate Jenny and Red Scare. Like, she just doesn't have time for that. She calls him Wade, so she immediately puts him on guard that she knows his real name, which is uncommon in the – I don't even know, necessarily know if the police know each other's names, because they are all supposed to be secret, but the fact that she knows his real name puts him on edge a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He asks, or she asks, if a talk screen was run on Judd's corpse, and Looking Glass responds, Judd was definitely hanged. No talk screen was run because there was no need. And so she's trying to figure out if maybe there wasn't some other foul play going on with Judd, and that maybe these police are covering it up, you know, because he was one of them kind of thing. Lori wants to know how they found the ranch in the first episode where the 7th Cavalry were getting those watch batteries. She knows Angela Abar's name. She mentions Angela Abar by name. And again, Looking Glass is not happy about that. The fact that she knows their real identities is dangerous to him. So he's not particularly happy about that. And he mentions that Angela is on PTO and she is preparing the eulogy for Judd's funeral, which is actually later in that day. And Lori says, I need to go. Then I guess I need to go change clothes because I got a funeral to go to like real soon.
Yeah, a couple things on this scene. Sure. I got the impression that like she seemed a little taken aback by what was going on here. I mean, she jokes about the idea that his rights are being violated, but that puts the idea in the audience's head to me. And then she walks in looking around at everything that's happening in this warehouse. It's kind of horrific, no matter what you think like the white supremacists are. The police don't seem to be respecting, you know, their rights, their right to legal counsel, you know, all of this stuff. So I don't know if that is going to mean anything later on, but to me, I felt like she didn't like what was going on, especially we know she doesn't like the cops wearing masks. So, and then the other thing I thought was weird was Wade was obviously, off kilter when she mentioned his name and she mentioned Angela's name. But he was very intent on grabbing the remote control back. And there was a pretty focused like shot of them passing the controller to him with this squid eye in the background. I mean, I don't know what that specifically means, but it was very intentional. And it seems to me that Wade has some sort of secret going on. Like he didn't want to be exposed by maybe what the pod could reveal, or he just didn't want to lose control of it. And he talks about the toxicology report. You know, he lies that there was no need, basically. I think there may be a cover for that where, like, Judd did cocaine that night. So maybe they didn't do a toxicology just to cover for him. But there may be more to that. Yeah, that's basically... I got suspicious of Wade because he doesn't seem to get along with Angela very much, but he also treats that suspect walking out of the pod at that moment like really nicely. He says just for the protection of the officers, we need to put a blindfold on you. And he seems like really nice and respectful of this suspect. Mm-hmm. And he says like, take him off the board. But earlier when he talks to Angela in the car, it's very antagonistic and not agreeable. So I wonder about him.
About Looking Glass?
Looking Glass, yeah.
Okay.
So, but, you know, there's lots of red herrings. There's lots of Chekhov's mm-hmm. guns in the show. There's lots of things being thrown at me. So I'm just trying to get a handle on it, you know?
We see a super quick cut and Lori pulls in back into the hotel and we see the sign, and the sign for the hotel is the Black Freighter Inn and Suites. And each of the parking spots has an electric car charging port. So this is again before electric cars were a thing, you know, in our world. So this was reminiscent of Dr. Manhattan and electric cars being a thing in this universe. And Black Freighter was the name of, there was an interspersed pirate comic inside of the original Watchmen, and it told this story of this kind of gruesome pirate story. And anyway, that little mini story was called the Black Freighter. So this is a little nod to the mini comic.
Hmm.
And we see Lori prepping for the funeral, and she straps a gun to her leg, which, I mean, I guess that's a normal thing to do if you're an FBI agent and you're going anywhere. It just seemed a little strange to me, like I'm going to a funeral, so I'm going to bring my gun. But, you know, maybe that's what you do.
Oh, I watched this episode twice. I didn't even catch that part. I mean, that makes sense later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't catch any of that, what you just said. But
yeah, that's all inside baseball stuff. You don't necessarily have to catch it. It just is interesting.
Yeah. There is sort of shots. So here again, she's telling the joke. This is the part of the joke is the hero number three. This is when she talks about the blue god. Mm-hmm. Intercut with this is like the funeral procession and showing her driving towards the cemetery. They go to the entrance and they have to surrender their guns. The agent seems pretty nervous about that, but she's like, just respect, or I can't remember what she says, but like, oh, respect to the dead, or show some respect or something. And so she makes him hand the gun over, and herself does.
So two things. Yeah, she gives Petey her gun to give to the cops, which, mm-hmm. you know, she's just saying, you know, hey, okay, we'll do whatever we got to do to get into this place. But we know, and we definitely see later, she has a gun strapped to her leg and she uses it later. So it's no big deal for her to give her gun up because she's got another one, right?
Yeah.
And you got to also remember that the cops are not allowed to carry guns in this universe. So that's also why it's a bigger deal. You know, like Petey's like, I finally, you know, I'm a big grown up FBI agent. I get to carry a gun and now you're making me give it up kind of thing.
Yeah, you see them put the gun in like one of those lock devices that have to be like released, I guess, by their weird policy thing.
What we see, I want to talk about one more thing before you go on, not to interrupt, but there's an overhead shot of the cars pulling up to the cemetery, and the cemetery is named Tartarus Acres. And Tartarus was where so the Titans were what essentially existed before the Greek gods. So before Zeus and Hera and all that, there were the Titans. And Tartarus was where the Titans sent their enemies. And it was essentially the underworld. And it's a terrible place. It's essentially hell. So this would literally be the worst possible name you could have for a cemetery, would be naming your cemetery anything to do with hell. I did make note that Tartarus is essentially hell to the Titans, and Elysium is heaven to the Titans. I don't think Elysium comes into this, but I've actually heard Elysium a couple other places recently, so I thought it was interesting to learn that Elysium means heaven.
Is that real, like, mythology, or is that within this universe?
Now, that's real mythology. If you Google Tartarus, it will talk about Titans and how it relates to the underworld, and essentially kind of like prison or, a bad place.
Oh, okay. I've heard the word Elysium before, but I haven't heard Tartarus, so that's interesting. So I guess we see Blake introduce herself to Angela and her husband in this next scene. Mm-hmm. And she kind of asked to talk with Angela sometime. Angela says she's not a cop anymore, Blake says, okay, and gives her card, which Angela reads her title or department, Anti-Vigilante Task Force. And Blake says, you know how you can tell the difference between a masked cop and a vigilante? And Angela says, no, and Blake says, yeah, me neither. Like, pretty disrespectful,
a little on the nose, yes,
especially, you know, at a funeral.
Right, yeah.
You gotta imagine Angela's, her radar is going off quite a bit. So they perform like a firing squad. Judd's wife talks and introduces Angela, who then walks up and speaks. She talks about the White Knight and how lucky they were. And they made a pact about what each of them would say at each other's funerals. She gets out a note and starts singing a song with the words, "I'm headed for the last roundup. Get along, little doggy." Over and over. It's kind of a weird thing.
It's kind of just like an old, like, folksy cowboy song.
Mm-hmm.
I looked it up. It doesn't necessarily. It didn't jump out of me as meaning anything. I think it was an old Gene Autry song.
Interesting. It was a weird scene. I think it was trying to be emotional a bit, but there's just this is a touch point for me because, like, I want to be emotionally invested in this show, right? I want to know the characters. I want to know their motivations. I want to know when things are sad, when things are happy, when things are bad, when they're good. But there's so many mysteries layered upon references upon mysteries. I can't really feel like I know these characters. I don't know if Angela is really sad. I don't know if the scene is really trying to portray something emotional or referential. All I know is that there's weird references kind of happening. So it's kind of like my gripe so far with the show. I appreciate like the depth and density of what's going on, but I'm just not getting very much character, oomph. I'm just not getting any. I'm not loving any of the characters so far.
Okay,
I guess.
Fair enough.
I mean, I like Lori so far. I mean, Lori's pretty cool. I'm getting her a little bit, but it just seems secondary. The characters seem secondary to what they're trying to build in this world and all the references and like the world building definitely is head and shoulders, I think, above everything else.
Okay.
Okay. So we hear ticking, and then we see a Rorschach mask dude sneak into the second cemetery from like an underground tunnel into a mausoleum structure. He exits the structure and then into the funeral area and shows a bomb vest and says, "Nobody fucking move." Says the bomb is wired to his heart, and if he dies, the bomb will kill everyone. He then addresses Senator Keene and says, "You are the race traitor. Surrender yourself or everyone dies." Keene quickly surrenders himself, is grabbed by the dude, and then we see him get shot in the face. And then we see that Blake is holding a gun. She had a backup gun.
We see blood splash all over Keene's face. So they were standing really close. She shoots him, you know, and Senator Keene's maybe a foot away from him. So she shoots the guy in the head and the blood splashes on Keene's face.
Yeah, this is like the big action scene of the episode. We hear the bomb start beeping. Angela tells everyone to run. Angela grabs the dead body and pushes it into the grave, like, hole, and then pushes the coffin over top just in time for the explosion to be kind of blocked by the coffin and Judd's body. And at first, I actually watched this episode twice. I've been seeming like I have to do that to kind of, like, catch everything, or at least catch enough of what's going on. And the first time I thought, like, why wouldn't it explode right away? But I got it. Like, I get that he got shot in the head. His heart wouldn't, like, immediately stop beating. It would be pumping blood for a while. And so that makes sense that there's a bit of time, you know, between when he got shot in the head and then when the bomb would detect his heartbeat stop.
Is that true? Doesn't your brain send mechanical impulses to your heart to beat, or does it beat on its own?
I mean, it's the nervous system. It's not really the brain. I mean, I don't know enough
about your muscles that work on electrical impulses from your brain. I assumed that your heart does the same, but maybe not. Yeah. Maybe.
I mean, if you have a bullet lodged in your brain, it's not like it just immediately stops. Everything stops working. I assume like your consciousness, you know, you get knocked out and then it depends on where it's shot maybe, like, but at least I could see an explanation for that, but maybe not.
And I did write down, this is the slowest bomb ever, because he gets shot in the head and then it starts to beep like it recognizes that his heart's not beating or something. And then it's like, I don't know, a full 30 seconds before the bomb blows up. Anyway.
No, I would bet that there's an explanation, a medical explanation why that would happen. Like your heart isn't going to immediately stop just because you got a bullet in the brain. The bullet in the brain is definitely going to take you out consciously, but your body probably still has some like residual, like
maybe for nervous a couple system seconds, activity. Sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, my dad is basically a doctor. He was a high school health teacher. So
yeah, there you go.
I know what I'm.
We've talking been looking about for an excuse to bring him in. Let's do it.
That was a joke in our family. We always say like, yeah, my dad is basically a doctor. He knows what's going on. Every time we had like a little health problem.
Oh yeah.
My dad would pretend he knows everything. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
My wife always gives medical advice to the, you know, kids, and then she always ends it with, after all my years in medical school, this is what I've learned, right?
Yeah.
So that's the end of the funeral scene. The only other thing that I will make mention is when Lori introduces herself to Angela and they have kind of that weird back and forth, she actually introduces herself to Cal as well and shakes his hand. And Cal kind of has this weird look on his face, like, and he says, "Have we met before?" He kind of has this weird deja vu look on his face. But Lori says, "No, I don't think so." And that's the end of that scene. But it's worth noting that Lori does meet Cal because she mentions later, she talks about how hot Angela's husband is. So you need to know that she does acknowledge that Cal is there, and she kind of like gives him the once over. The next scene after the funeral, we cut to, we see a statue, like a bronze statue bust with a white mask on it, you know, like the purple eye patch mask kind of thing. The camera pans slowly to the right. We see a record player, a globe, an astrolabe, some maps, and a telescope. Pans a little bit more. We see like a metal erector set, some blueprints, a catapult, and some cool like Da Vinci-esque drawings. So we cut back to the director of the play, and we see that this guy is, he's in an inventor. He's trying to, he's working on something. That's all we know.
This is like the like the British countryside castles. Yes. We're like in this other completely new area. Yeah,
and so we know that this guy is working on something. We knew that he was before because he had this weird play that he was working on, and you know, this is, we see a little bit more behind the curtain of, you know, what it is, what his skill set is, and what he's doing. At one point, he's cutting leather. And he's working on a terrarium. He's actually, you know, heating up some metal to cut this glass. So he has some chops, you know, to in manufacturing. He puts a suit of armor on Mr. Phillips. And he says, Mr. Phillips says, oh, I have no doubt that it will work this time. And the director responds, that, Mr. Phillips, is because you are incapable of doubt. We see a close-up of Phillips's face behind this metal armor, and it has like the glass, presumably from the terrarium that he cut. We see, so it's a close-up of that face, and then it cuts real quick, and then we see that same face, but now it's behind this. The face is now pale, and it's frozen after he takes the head off. So we don't know what happened to Phillips, but we know that he did not survive whatever happened. The director character gets very frustrated. He kicks the corpse and he just kind of goes on this swearing spree. We see that the corpse is very rigid. It appears to be frozen. And a new Mr. Phillips rides up and says, what went wrong, master? And the director guy responds, I think we're going to need a thicker skin. So he's working on some sort of contraption. He's got Phillips wearing this weird costume, ultimately ends up killing Phillips in some sort of weird frozen way. So if he's not burning Phillips's in this weird play that he's doing, he's somehow freezing them to death in this weird suit that he has. So
yeah, I got total Lost vibes from what is happening here. It seems so out of the blue, weird, like there's some game happening. Or like some environmental just out craziness that's happening that he's like trying to like create some solution for. I mean, we don't know anything, but like nope. I definitely got like Lost vibes from this.
So we see you mentioned the next thing we see after he kicks the crap out of this frozen body is we see this director guy on horseback again, and he is riding past a sickle with a yellow cross skull and crossbones on it. And I believe this yellow skull and crossbones is a reference to the Black Freighter, the pirate ship from the original comic. I think it's just it's a throwaway image, but the point is that it's essentially a demarcation point. It's essentially the bounds of wherever this guy is, he is not allowed to go past. So what happens is he rides past, he gets out a bow and arrow, he shoots this bison, and he is attempting to, you know, harvest the skin off this bison or whatever. And then a bullet shoots right by his feet, and we see he looks up, and there's a guy on a horse kind of in a mask with a rifle, and he's basically kind of giving him, you know, admonishing him like, no, you're breaking the rules. You can't be where you are. You can't do what you're doing. And this is the first time we actually see this director guy defer to anybody else. He doesn't listen to Crookshanks. He doesn't listen to Phillips, but he defers to whoever this character is. We cut back to the castle. He has ridden back to the castle without this bison that he has killed, and he is very frustrated. He walks into the castle, and The Crookshanks and Phillips, they have a yellow and purple cake just like the other two. This one has three candles on it. The character is very frustrated, and he's sitting there just kind of fuming, basically, that he didn't get this bison. And then later, Crookshanks brings him a letter. She says, "Oh, excuse me, sir. I have a letter from the game warden. And I won't read you the entire letter, but essentially what it says is the game warden writes in this letter, he says, we agreed upon the terms of your captivity. So we learn that this character is in some type of captivity. And I mean, clearly he's living a pretty full life. He's not in jail. He's living a full life, but there are limitations with what he is allowed to do. And the game warden is essentially keeping him honest. And it's interesting to note that the letter is signed, your humble servant, the game warden. So they have this weird relationship where it's not, you know, like, hey, I'm your boss and I tell you what to do. Or this character defers to the game warden, but the game warden is also somehow a servant of this character.
I thought that was weird.
Yeah. It is weird. It is very weird. So he dictates a letter to Crookshanks. He says, you know, let's write a response. And he dictates this extremely formal letter with very flowery language. He mentions his purely recreational activities when he's hunting this bison. And anyway, he agrees, you know, essentially that he's going to follow the rules, but, you know, he's not happy about it. And then he says, and the camera like cuts to his face, and it says, signed Adrian Veidt. So we, on the third episode, we are given the reveal that this is indeed Adrian Veidt from the original comic. He is not dead, as the rest of the series has led us to believe, but he is somewhere we don't know. He is in this old English countryside where they don't have a lot of electricity, and he has got a bunch of like weird servants that are somehow clones of each other. And he is, in essence, in captivity by some game warden. So we still don't know what time period he is in, where he is. There's a mystery going on here as well. He tells Crookshanks to prepare his horse, Bucephalus. And Bucephalus was the horse of Alexander the Great and considered one of the most famous horses of classical antiquity. And it's worth mentioning that Adrian Veidt is a huge fan of Alexander the Great. He designed most of his empire after Alexander the Great. So the fact that his horse is named after him as well is just another nod to how much respect he has for Alexander the Great. And the scene ends with Veidt putting on the full Ozymandias uniform we know from the original comic, that the long flowing purple cape, the purple eye mask, the yellow filigree around his head and shoulders. You know, it's kind of like this superhero reveal of, okay, so we've been teased for two episodes that this is maybe Ozymandias, and then this is the reveal, and it ends with, you know, basically showing off his full costume.
Yes.
That cover everything?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I thought. I clued on that one. I got it.
I think it was pretty obvious early on that it was Veidt, but they did a good job of making it just weird enough that it might be someone else or this might be a different time. So there's still more mystery to be solved here, but
there's very little answers in this episode and way more questions.
Yes. I'm looking forward to your questions at the end.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to do the next scene?
Okay, so I guess we go back to the quote-unquote real world with Keane at a press conference at night talking about the attack at the funeral. Side note, I think this, you know, politicians in TV shows typically aren't to be trusted. I think he's definitely lying about something. My instinct is to suspect he is in with the 7th Cavalry somehow. And this is some kind of show. The politician is obviously not to be trusted, but I don't know anything. I mean, this is my instinct. This is where I'm at. I'm telling you. The agent and Blake are listening to Petey, the agent, and Blake are listening to Keene's speech. The agent jokes about getting the autograph from Blake now that they talked about. Mm-hmm. She takes his coffee, walks into the crime scene, enters the mausoleum, and looks at the hole. Angela pops up with her laser goggles. And Blake asks her where the hole goes. Angela says it's right outside the fence, about 300 meters. Blake thanks her for saving them. Angela says it was Judd that jumped on the grenade. Blake says she's going to dig up Judd's body tomorrow because there's more investigation. Yep.
Mm-hmm. She says, I sure as shit can't exhume him now because now his body's in a million pieces.
Right. Yeah. Does she say that she can't do any of those toxicology at this point? I can't remember.
I don't think it comes up, but.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Could you do a tox screening on a body part that was blown up? Would you get chemicals? I don't know. Probably.
I don't know. But she says she was going to dig up the body. And there's more investigation that the cops have missed. Like that there was wheelchair tracks next to the crime scene. Blake also mentions a secret compartment in Judd's closet.
It's worth noting that mm-hmm. Angela does a really good job of playing dumb because she says tire tracks at the scene and she says, oh, really? What kind of vehicle was it? And she says, oh, I didn't say it was a vehicle. It was a wheelchair. And she doesn't flinch. She's you know, what's the word? She got a good poker face. And then, she says, hey, mm-hmm. did you know he had a secret compartment in his closet? And Angela's like, wait, what? No, I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of out of her perspective, so I didn't, like, I was kind of, it seems to be from the POV of Lori at this point, but mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. I mean, she plays it cool. She says there was a bust inside, but there was something on it she thinks that got removed. We know that was the, like, KKK-looking outfit, mm-hmm. hood, you know. That was in the secret compartment. It's a pretty great scene between these two, I think. Blake says, this much I know, men who end up hanging in trees with secret compartments in their closets tend to think of themselves as the good guys, and those who protect them think of they're the good guys too. But here's the thing about me, Sister Knight. I eat good guys for breakfast. I mean, great line. And then mm-hmm. Angela does like a dead ass stare, and then
like a
says,
great like, dramatic pause, right?
Yeah. And then does like a sarcastic ooh, like she's supposed to be scared. She, you know, dumps out the coffee Blake gave her down the hole and leaves. She leaves the goggles behind, which I think was a little weird, but it was a pretty cool scene between them. It was like pretty cold.
So the only thing that, you may not have picked up from the show is because Lori says my dad had a secret compartment. And so now I look for that whenever I'm at a crime scene, which is why she looked for it at Judd's house. And the reason her dad had a secret compartment we talked about earlier was her dad was the comedian and he had that secret compartment in his apartment where he hid his old uniform. And you see that when Rorschach goes and investigates after he dies. So that's just kind of like a running thing, you know, like sort of how like the Jedi always cut off hands. Apparently, you know, having secret compartments is the thing in the Watchmen universe. But Lori is very much aware of that. And she did find that, which is kind of impressive. I think at one point she says she really suspects that Angela had something to do with it. You know, like, you know, maybe you're covering up for him. Maybe you guys are having an affair, you know, could be, you know. She's doing her job. She sees that maybe there's more going on here. And she's putting Angela on notice that, hey, something hinky's going on here. I see it. I know you see it. I'm watching you, essentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the last scene of the episode, we see Lori back at the hotel. And it's been a long day. She's, you know, almost gotten blown up and she's been dealing with this murder investigation all day. And she finally opens up this briefcase And we cut to the inside and we see that it indeed, it is like what? I don't know, like a 18 inch long Dr. Manhattan, like reflective dildo. And it has like separate detachable balls. Like it's so weird looking. And yeah, I think you see, I think you see in the briefcase. Yeah. Don't you see the magazine cover of the two of them of Silk Spectre and Dr. Manhattan together? So she's just, she's going down memory lane and thinking about Dr. Manhattan, right? And like, just when she's about to get into it, there's a knock on the door. Or no, I think it cuts and there's a knock on the door and it's Petey. And she has basically decided that that's not what she wants to do. So she calls Petey over for a quickie, right? And it cuts to Petey and Lori in bed and he's passed out and he's wearing that cheesy mask that he had on in the plane. And she's just kind of like lying there awake, staring at the ceiling. It was such a great scene that he's, you know, like passed out post-coitus and he's still wearing his little mask. And then it cuts to the very end and we see that Lori is back in the Dr. Manhattan phone booth and she's telling the end of that brick joke. So she says that the three heroes all got sent to hell because God wasn't impressed with how many people they killed. And little girl rolls up and he says, you know, hey, what are you doing? You know, like, you want to get into heaven? And she basically says, no, I'm the little girl from the first brick joke, the one that she said she told wrong. And now the brick comes down, hits God in the head. His brains come out. He kills God. Girl goes into heaven and takes over heaven. So I forget exactly what that's called, but it's, you know, like extreme delayed reaction, like something is introduced in the very beginning and it's up in the air and it doesn't come back and circle back and figure into the plot until the very end. So I think that's a weird, like, in universe way of explaining how some of the things in this show are going to be explained. There may be a lot of things that don't make any sense until like the very last episode or one of the last. You're like, oh, I forgot that was even a thing. Like, you have a list of questions, right? But I think, you know, most normal people that are watching this, you know, will have forgotten some of those things that happened in the first or second episode that will be explained. She finishes telling this joke about God dying and going to hell. And she says, roll on snare drum curtains, which is the exact line that is told as the voiceover essentially in the comic as the comedian falls out the window. So that's an homage to the original. And she basically she hangs up the phone after having told this joke. I think she makes mention of, you know, I don't think this will ever, you know, reach you, but it's kind of nice knowing that, you know, maybe I can still talk to you. You know, again, I think it's just therapy for her.
Yeah, and you see her crying a bit here. Or yeah, like
she
almost
sheds a single
crying.
Tear, right.
Pretty emotional, yeah.
So she hangs up the phone and, you know, a little voiceover from the computer comes on and it says 40 seconds for the message to reach Mars, which I believe if you do the math, that's the amount of time it would take the speed of light to travel from Earth to Mars, but don't hold me to it. And she steps out from the Dr. Manhattan phone booth and she kind of like breathes a sigh of relief. She's, you know, it's been a long day. And as she's walking away, a car, a destroyed car, it's actually Angela's car from the last episode that got magneted up with Will in it, is dropped right in front of her, you know, maybe 8 feet in front of her. And it's worth noting that the car falls. So the computer said it's going to take 40 minutes for the message to reach Mars. And literally 43 seconds later, a car falls from the sky right in front of her.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
The timing is, I watched it twice to make sure the timing was right. And then she looks up at the sky and you see kind of like this orange flashing light. I don't know if it's a star or what, but she looks up and she sees something. And I think she thinks, or the audience is supposed to think, you know, hey, Dr. Manhattan got this message and this is his way of responding to her. I don't know. I don't remember how this plot point reveals itself. It's kind of weird. Like, if Dr. Manhattan did get this message, like, what a weird way to respond. Like, hey, I got your message. Here's a car, right? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's it. And I assume that this is the car that was lifted up with the old black guy in the wheelchair. Yes. That was taken away. in with like a magnetic arm thing. So it's, I wouldn't assume that it would be Dr. Manhattan who's way up on Mars. He's not flying around with magnets. So that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. It's just a big car that crashes in front of her, and she seems to connect it with Dr. Manhattan. She looks up, like you said, at like some glowing star point in the sky. But why would it connect when we've seen earlier in the last episode, it was carried away by a magnet from a spaceship? So I guess to deduce, maybe Dr. Manhattan is flying around in a spaceship with a magnet attached to it. Who knows? But nothing makes sense.
It could be a red herring too. Who knows? That's the end of the episode is that this car drops and Lori looks up and she sees a flashing star of some kind, and that's it. And then the credits roll, and that's the end of episode two. And I feel like, you know, all the story points are wrapped up and you have no questions left on your list, I assume.
Oh yeah. It's all completely tight. I could probably stop watching at this point, I think.
Right. Yeah. I think this is a great place to stop. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So what's left on your list? I'm curious.
What's left there? Okay. So
what's been added, I guess I should say.
There is two answered questions now that we know the master guy in the castle is Adrian Veidt. We know a bit more about Senator Keene. That wasn't like a huge question, but we know more about him. The previous questions we had that I have a running list of, Chrome Head Guy, we still don't really know why it's like a mirror. Squid Rain, the watch batteries. I mean, the guy had a bomb vest, but there was no connection to specific batteries. The flying spaceships being a thing, we don't know. I mean, I guess if you know in the comics, it's like the owl inventor, guy who's inventor, and it's probably like one of his spaceships, but we don't know that in the show. And I'm really trying to judge the show on the text.
That's fair. That's fair.
The old man in the wheelchair, of course, zero new information on him.
Pills for memory. He was not present in this episode at all, right?
Impervious to heat. Knew about the 200 pounds thing. Why he was there? Why was he there at Judge lynching? Spaceship magnet saves him. We see the car fall from the sky in front of Blake at the end here, but that doesn't answer anything. And then what's like Angela's relationship to him? Okay, so the people who attacked Judd. That seems to be the main mystery, mm-hmm. whether it's the 7th Cavalry or not. Earlier, the Topher can make things float with a floating magnet thing. I'm still going to hang on to that because like, maybe that's like a futuristic toy in this world, but it's not explained, okay? I'm going to hang on to that one.
You're talking about that little castle, the Lego castle thing he had?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
I'm going to hang on to that, okay?
Yeah, you it's hang on to whatever
and
you want.
I'm guessing they're just not going to explain that. The man on Angela's doorstep, we don't know about that. Rolf Moeller, the hooded justice guy from the TV show. The scene at the weird English castle, the clones, the weird play. All of these things are existing questions that did not get answered. Whether he can use the clone as a body for something, maybe that is slightly answered because he's trying to do experiments. The tomatoes on trees is also, there's a bit more information because it's mentioned in the letter. The game warden thanks him for the delicious tomatoes.
Right. Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. He's admonishing him. He's like, yeah, you know, we have rules. You're not allowed to go out to this spot. Oh, by the way, thanks for the delicious tomatoes.
Yeah. That is weird. It's pretty funny. But the anniversary, the pocket watch. Okay. So new questions that have been added to the list. New character, Lori Blake. We've learned a bit about her in this episode, but we don't know the full extent of why she's famous. We see this magazine cover at the very end and people are kind of talking around it, but we don't know the history. She's pretty mysterious still. Why is she pretend calling Dr. Manhattan? Why the blue dildo? I mean, I can come up with some answers, but I'm kind of relying on the show to do some work, some of the work for me, you know. She mentions her dad had a secret compartment. You explain this as the comedian, and the secret compartment that he had, but it's a question for me. I wrote it down because it's a question for me, and you didn't explain it beforehand. So,
okay.
like I want the okay. Maybe I'm expecting too much from this show that's trying to do something different, but I'm judging the show and I'm having questions based on the text of the show. And I've said that before. Okay. The Millennium Clock that we saw earlier, zero knowledge of that. New questions about Adrian Veidt, the whole game warden. He's allowed to shoot buffalo with an arrow, I guess, but not stab it with a knife, because that's when he got warned. I guess, like you mentioned, there's a specific demarcation where he's not allowed to go past. So maybe that whole activity was not allowed in this weird game, trying to make a suit that doesn't freeze the clone, ? Like, there's a lot more. There's just too much more mystery there to even like describe and list, but there, yeah. So those are that's what I have for new questions. I've probably missed many, but
nope. Okay. You got the good ones. All right. I think you're on the right track. I don't want to say
I'm not on a track. I don't have any.
No, you're picking up the right things. I should say, I think you are correct to be, you know, curious about those things. And most of those do get an answer, and in a satisfying way. So I love the storytelling, the method of storytelling in this show. I wish more shows did this, right? I mean, this to me feels like, I think I said it before, you know, this feels like Knives Out, the TV show, right? You know, so I think that's sort of what they're trying to do with this. And, you know, and it works for me. And they keep presenting, you know, new weird mysteries. You know, the world that these people live in is weird to begin with. And then, you know, the story on top of it is also weird. So those two put together make a good combination, you know, and ultimately there's a mystery that does get solved. Like, yeah, who killed Judd and why? So we got six more episodes.
Is there a LeBlanc type character in this show that we can kind of like see through the eyes of, or at least think we're seeing through the eyes of? I know they play on that in Knives Out, like there's more information that what's led on, but like none of the characters in the show seem like they are surprised at what's happening, or there's not like one character that I don't know, that just feels vulnerable. Everyone seems to kind of know what they're doing. They're all kind of badasses. At least they are involved in things that, you know, we are supposed to expect that they know what's going on. So I don't know. I wouldn't compare it to Knives Out in the same way. I would have preferred at least one character that, I guess Angela is a pretty good character to kind of like stick with. But she was not in this episode at all. Basically, we didn't see any of her point of view or any like advancement of her character. It was mostly an introduction to this Lori Blake character. So
I think to answer your question, is there a LeBlanc character in this? I think both Lori and Angela Abar are the LeBlanc here. I mean, they're both detectives, right? I mean, it's their job to solve this. The question is, you know, Angela's coming at it from the angle of, hey, my best friend was murdered. And Angela's coming at it from, hey, this, you know, head of this police organization was murdered and all kinds of hinky stuff is going on in this town. So I think, you know, these other cops are involved. So they're coming at the same case from two entirely different angles. And, you know, ultimately they're going to meet in the middle and we're going to figure out, you know, who's right and how does that all land. So, yeah, I think there's very much a LeBlanc. There's a couple LeBlancs in this, and they will throughout the show, you know, slowly reveal more pieces of this mystery and it will fall into place.
Well, you give me great comfort because on my own with the show, I would feel very lost and like, yeah, I don't feel like there's any possible way to like make this all make sense in a satisfying way. But we're only three episodes in. I can acknowledge that there's a lot of setup that's happening. You know, if I was only in like maybe a third into a Knives Out movie, I would probably be maybe equally trepidatious. You know, sure. I probably was the same sort of like, oh my gosh, what is going on here? So I'm in that state, but like suspended because I need to watch the rest of it. So
I've said it before. I mean, I went into like, I think the last two episodes going, there's absolutely no way they're going to wrap this up. They're going to leave a gigantic cliffhanger for season two. And mm-hmm. I'm going to be really frustrated, like Lost style all over again. And I wasn't. So yeah. Don't worry. It does get wrapped up. The intention of this show from the beginning was that they were going to do one season and it was going to be one and done. So the story gets wrapped up in a satisfactory fashion.
I will say that this episode made me more interested. It became more interesting to know that Dr. Manhattan seems to be having a real impact in the story, at least somehow. So it's like, it's pretty intriguing to know that Dr. Manhattan's going to have an impact because he's a very interesting character. Like I remember him from the comic as being like, and the way they talk about him being so disconnected but like all powerful, like that kind of character is intriguing and I would like to see him interact in the world. So I have gained some more interest, so yeah, it's pretty cool.
Okay, well, we've been talking for a while. I think that's probably enough for this episode. Six more episodes to go and it only gets better from here, and that's saying something because this was a great episode. So we'll be back next time.
Okay, bye.